This is a production of Cornell University.
My name is Warren Allman. I'm the director of the Paleontological Research Institution, which is the parent organization of the building that you are sitting in. And welcome to the beginning of Earth Day week at the Museum of the Earth. Before we built this building, I said to myself, we've got to do something to celebrate Earth Day once we build the Museum of the Earth. And gradually over the last few years, we've been ramping up, and this is our biggest event ever, and we're very pleased that you all came here to join us. First of all, I want to thank Wegmans, who has been the sponsor of Earth Day here at the museum for most of the last 5 years. By the way, this is our fifth anniversary. 2008 is the fifth anniversary of the museum, and Wegmans has been a strong supporter of us, and we want to thank them for that. I want to thank our members and our donors, many of whom are here in the room. If you want more events like this to be possible, please become a member and find out more up at the front desk about that. Tomorrow is Family Day, the Family Day piece of our Earth Day celebration. So if you have people of a wide variety of ages, please come. There'll be lots of activities, including craft activities. We're premiering a brand new program called Botany Through the Ages tomorrow, which is of interest to a wide variety of people, and Earth Story Time twice at 11 and 1 tomorrow, and tours, as always, of the museum at 11, 1, and 3 tomorrow. So please join us tomorrow for family-related Earth Day activities. And my ever-diligent staff asks me to remind you that summer is upon us, and summer is a big deal here at the museum, and there's lots coming up. You are sitting in our temporary exhibit space, which has been kind of disassembled for you tonight. The cases are over here next to the ramp. This is actually you are sitting in the middle of a temporary exhibit on a 50-million-year-old fossil lake in Wyoming. So please come back and see that. This exhibit will be up through early June. And then starting on June 21st, we will have a really exciting major new temporary exhibit on dinosaur eggs called Hatching the Past here for the whole summer. So please come back to that. We will be doing, for I think about the 10th year, we will be doing our interpretive gorge walks in area gorges. Those are named in honor of James Pitordi, who is a Ithacan and victim of 9/11. And we're very happy this year to be partnering with the Cayuga Nature Center on summer camp for the first time. So all that is coming up this summer. There's a bunch of copies of our newsletter up at the top, so if you want to learn more, please do so. I'm going to take director's prerogative while the sun sets a little further to give a little bit longer than normal introduction to our speaker tonight, because he's a very special speaker for this institution. He's a very special guest of mine. In 1983, in the fall of 1983, a very young Harvard graduate student went to Washington, D.C. to meet with the vice president of the World Wildlife Fund, and having been introduced to him by a professor, a mutual acquaintance. And this graduate student came to this meeting, to this dinner, thinking that it was some kind of interview. The vice president of the World Wildlife Fund said, "Well, when can you leave for Brazil?" And so the graduate student was me, and I was a graduate student in invertebrate paleontology, which has not very much to do with tropical biology in the way people usually think about it. But my firm contention then, and it still is that you cannot be an evolutionary biologist, which most invertebrate paleontologists claim to be, without understanding the modern tropics, where evolution is clearly at its most exuberant. And you simply can't understand evolution unless you've seen the extreme case. And I had spent a little bit of time in tropical rainforests before as an undergraduate, but I'd never been to the Amazon. And so I said, "Well, how do you go to the Amazon then?" And so here I was having dinner with essentially Dr. Amazon, and Dr. Amazon sent me to the Amazon. So buried in my, the result of that was that buried in my curriculum vitae of papers about snails and geology is a paper in the Journal of Tropical Ecology on Amazonian frogs. And that experience was profound to me. It did exactly what I thought it would do. It taught me evolutionary biology in a way that I would not have learned otherwise. And so the reason I tell you that story is that is entirely emblematic of our speaker tonight. Tom Lovejoy got his both undergrad and graduate degree at Yale University. He, very shortly after getting his PhD from Yale in 1971, he came to the World Wildlife Fund intending apparently to spend just a couple of years. But he was there from 1973 to 1987 and is widely credited for the direction of that organization having a main focus in the tropics, particularly the New World tropics. From 1985 to 1987, he was the fund's executive vice president. He is generally credited with introducing us to the problem of tropical deforestation. And I remember that very clearly. Being a graduate student, nobody talked about tropical deforestation in the early 1980s. Now it's on the back of cereal boxes. And that is largely credited, not by me, but by folks who watch such things as the work of Tom Lovejoy. He was actually the first person to use the term biological diversity in print in 1980, and he made the first projections of global extinction rates in the Global 2000 report to the president. And that may sound arcane to you, but another point of history here, 25 years ago when I was a graduate student, it was a very novel, wacko idea to say that we might be on the verge of a mass extinction to rival or to equal the time of the dinosaurs. That was out there 25 years ago. It is now mainstream stuff. It is part of the exhibits here at the museum, and it's in most textbooks. And again, that is in large part due to Tom Lovejoy. Tom Lovejoy invented the notion that is now quite widespread of what are called debt for nature swaps. This means taking developing countries' debt and retiring it in exchange for those countries setting aside large tracts of land for conservation purposes. And this has been done now all over the world, and the dollar figures, the most recent dollar figures are way in excess of $1 billion that has been devoted to conservation that would not otherwise have gone to that. Tom introduced that notion in an op-ed piece in the New York Times, which is also emblematic of how Tom works. He floats an idea out there and then kind of watches and sees what happens. In 1987, I remember actually being in a meeting with Tom when the negotiations were going on. In 1987, he was appointed Assistant Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution for Environmental and External Affairs, and had an office in the castle on the Mall in Washington. And from there, he directed a lot of Smithsonian programs and steered a great deal of Smithsonian attention and prestige to issues of tropical deforestation. In 1988, he served briefly on the White House Science Council. From 1989 to 1992, on the President's Council of Advisors in Science and Technology. And in 1993, he became the science advisor to then Secretary of the Interior, Bruce Babbitt. And he held that post at a very crucial time. The 1990s were good for conservation, and Tom was very involved in directing the federal government's efforts particularly in tropical conservation. In 1998, he became the chief biodiversity advisor to the World Bank. I bet you didn't know the World Bank has a biodiversity advisor. But he was the chief biodiversity advisor to the World Bank, and that is also symbolic of how Tom works. In 2001, he became senior advisor to the president of the United Nations Foundation, which was created by Ted Turner some time ago. In 2002, he assumed his present position as president of the H. John Heinz III Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment. It's not a household name of an institution, but if you look at what it does, it's actually a very powerful organization that combines scientific expertise with policy, and I can't think of anybody better than Tom Lovejoy to direct that. I remembered in my distant memory, and I dug up this afternoon, an article from Science Magazine in 1990. This is a three-page, Science Magazine is the magazine for professional scientists in the United States, and there's a three-page, basically, personality profile of Tom Lovejoy in 1990 Science Magazine, and I just want to read you one little tiny piece of this. It coins the phrase, the Lovejoy effect. And the Lovejoy effect is a unique capacity for engaging others, many of them powerful public figures, politicians, media moguls, and movie stars, in his cause, which is saving the fragile ecology of the Amazon rainforest. That was 1990, when Tom's ambitions were fairly narrow. I have heard it said by more than one very authoritative person that Tom Lovejoy is the most important environmentalist of the last century. I believe that. What I think is meant by that, is that Tom has accomplished in more fundamental ways than almost anyone else, fundamental changes in the way that really matter, that put boots on the ground, that puts money out there to actually do things instead of just talking about it. I should also mention that Tom is an evolutionary biologist. He introduced bird banding to the Amazon basin in his PhD thesis. He's a very accomplished ornithologist. He is a unique blend of science and policy, and he's exactly what the world needs right now. And we are immensely, immensely pleased to have him here at the museum. Thank you, Tom, for being here.
Well, thank you very much for that, Warren. That's the kind of introduction you just want to sit down. But it's also, it's a real delight to be here at the Museum of the Earth and to see what Warren has put together in his time here. I would only get little snippets from him in the past, and to see it in the brick and mortar reality with special exhibits and all the rest is just really breathtaking. So congratulations to Warren and all your team. And I would also like to say what a delight it is for me to have Carl and Lynn Leopold here. And you will have heard an earlier version of this speech last April in Ann Arbor, but I hope you like the way it has evolved. So what I want to talk about this evening is the interaction between climate change and the natural world. It's a subject I've been following for about 20 years. I've done two books on it with co-editors. In the first book, which came out in 1992, Time to Be for the Earth Summit in Rio, basically the book was about what might happen. By the time the second book came out, which I did with Lee Hanna in 2005, some of those things were already beginning to happen. And if there's one thing I hope you will take away from this presentation is that the natural world is more sensitive to climate change than literally any other of the agenda items that the convention and people worry about, and argues that we really need to get going fast and in a big way in addressing the challenge. So if we could have the next, please. Climate change is now certainly in the news all over the place next, sometimes with visions way out in the future. This is what New York would look like with 80 feet of sea level rise. That includes the loss of the Greenland ice cap and a lot of other things. But it has a sort of a personal meaning for me because my great-grandfather chaired the commission that designed the New York subway system, and it will be gone. Next slide, please. More modest and nearer term kinds of projections are shown here for Washington, New York, and San Francisco. The images along the top, the current situation, the images along the bottom with 2 or 3 feet of sea level rise. And I would draw your attention to the one on the lower right in which 3 feet of sea level rise literally triples the area of San Francisco Bay. Next slide, please. But it's basically about the interaction between climate change and the natural world that I want to talk about. I'll talk a teeny bit about climate change at the beginning and then get right into the kinds of things that are happening and then what may happen if we don't get our act together. Next. So I always like to spend a little time at the outset on this slide, which shows the temperature of the Earth for the past 120,000 years in Greenland. And the amplitude, of course, is higher there because the changes are greater there. But that same pattern would hold for climate change anywhere in the world you constructed such a graph. The first 910,000 years, you can see that abrupt climate change, in fact, is the natural condition. Usually all of this variation is buried in the much bigger time spans that are shown in temperature graphs. But what you see here is that abrupt climate change is the natural, more frequent way that climate moves in contrast to the linear and gradual way in which all the major global climate models move. And perhaps even more important is the last 10,000 years, that upper right-hand corner of that graph, a period of unusual stability in global climate. Buried in that 10,000 years is all recorded human history, a significant piece of our unrecorded human history, the origins of agriculture, and the origins of human settlements. So basically, one can only draw from that the conclusion that the entire human enterprise is based on the assumption of a stable climate, which the first part of that growth of that graph shows is not a safe assumption. And yet here we are, as Wally Broker of Columbia likes to say, poking the climate monster in the eye. Next slide, please. So it's driven by an increase in greenhouse gases. This is the familiar graph of increase of carbon dioxide measured from a volcano top in Hawaii. Next slide, please. And this is the concentration of carbon dioxide over the last 600,000 years. And you can see, if you look at the far right, that we are already way off the scale for CO2 concentrations in that quite lengthy time period. Next slide, please. A consequence of this increase in greenhouse gases, and there are others besides CO2, is an increase in the average temperature of the Earth. We're currently about 3/4 of a degree higher than in pre-industrial times. And because there is a lag time between the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere and the trapping of heat, we are already committed to an equal amount of temperature increase even if we stopped increasing greenhouse gases today. Next, please. This is to make the point that the whole concept of greenhouse gases on which the climate change modeling is based is actually not recent science. It goes all the way back to 1896 when Swedish scientist Arrhenius, addressing the question of why is the Earth habitable for humans and other forms of life, was able to work out the heat-trapping effect of greenhouse gases. And interestingly enough, with pencil and paper, Arrhenius calculated what doubling pre-industrial concentrations would do to the Earth's temperature, and the result comes out almost exactly where the very expensive supercomputer models come out. Next, please. So, what about the changes that are already occurring in nature? How is nature responding to the climate change that has already taken place? Next, please. A lot of it has to do in the physical sense with the change between the liquid and solid phases of water. So lakes are icing up later in the year. I'm sure there are data from Cayuga. And they are breaking up earlier in the spring. Next. Glaciers are in retreat in most parts of the world. So Glacier National Park will soon be that only in name. Next, please. In the tropics, there are glaciers on very high mountains like Kilimanjaro. All tropical glaciers are retreating at a rate where they will be gone within 12 years. So were Hemingway writing his short story today, he would have had to choose a different title for his short story. Next slide, please. And here is one of those glaciers, the one high in the Bolivian Andes, which is the water supply for La Paz, already 50% gone. Next slide, please. If we can click on that. Of course, the biggest changes between ice and the liquid water are up at the Arctic region up towards the pole. And this gives a graph of the annual increase and retreat of ice over the Arctic Ocean from about 1980 to 2007. And what is very clear from that graph, and you can see it on the next one, please, is that the process of retreat of ice in the Arctic Ocean is accelerating. Exactly what you would expect, because when there is no ice on a part of that ocean, the dark water is absorbing more heat. So it is accelerating, and the estimate for the first summer at which the Arctic Ocean will be ice-free for the first time in human history is no longer 2050, it's about 2015 to 2013. Next slide, please. Other interesting things that are happening with ice are shown here in this and the next graph on seismic activity generated by glaciers in Greenland. The gray bars along the bottom are the average seismic activity over a period of time going way back before 1993, and the green bars are the activity since that time. This shows that there is more seismic activity in the summer months, June, July, August, and September. What's happening is that the meltwater from the glacier is now actually finding its way down beneath the glacier, assisting the glacier's movement. Something that 10 years ago nobody really understood well about glaciers. Next slide, please. And here you can see when it's plotted year by year that the frequency of seismic activity generated by glaciers is accelerating. Yes?
What's the reason for the discontinuity in the green bars in the middle of the ground?
You mean like the year 2000?
Yeah.
Probably just some seasonal variation. But in any sort of numerical analysis, what you have is an accelerating function there. Next slide, please. So sea level rise has already been occurring. It's entirely due to the thermal expansion of water. And by the way, when ice melts in the Arctic Ocean, it does not lead to sea level rise any more than your glass of water would increase in its level as the ice cubes melt. So the issues about sea level rise are tied, one, to thermal expansion of water. Water simply expanding as it gets warmer, and any melt from ice on land. Next slide, please. So here you see the effects of this at the Blackwater National Refuge on Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. Here you have a combination of sea level rise and natural subsidence, but you can see that the Blackwater National Refuge soon will be only a water, an aquatic refuge. Next slide. And one of the, as yet, not nailed down aspects is the probability of increased intense tropical storm activity. The science on it is not nailed down yet, but it certainly looks as though it's headed that way. Next slide, please. And certainly, and this is statistically significant, the warmer summers and earlier snow melts in the American West have led to a statistically significant increase in forest fires and other wildfires in the American West and Southwest. Next slide, please. But it's the biology of all of this that has always driven me, and that's what I'm going to spend the rest of our time talking about. And what we're now seeing is a lot of organisms changing the timing in their life cycles. So lilacs are blooming earlier in New England. Next slide, please. Narcissus is blooming earlier at the Royal Botanic Garden at Kew. Next slide, please. Indeed, many flower species, flowering plant species, are blooming earlier at Kew. I expect there are data that people have been accumulating around here that show the same thing. Next slide, please. But it's not just plants that are changing the timing of significant events in their life history. It's also animals. So tree swallows are migrating earlier, nesting earlier, laying eggs earlier. A whole bunch of species of birds are doing that. One hummingbird species has even ceased to migrate. Next, please. And species are changing where they live. The Aedes checkerspot butterfly is probably the best studied butterfly in North America, although I'm sure the monarch may give it some competition in that category. But in any case, the Aedes checkerspot has clearly been abandoning lower altitude locations and moving upslope, and also moving northward and abandoning southern parts of its distribution. Next slide, please. In Europe, this particular butterfly species, next slide, please, just click it. Is moving, actually dozens of butterfly species are changing their range, and it has all, again, been tested statistically. Next slide, please. And the National Arbor Day Foundation, which one would hardly characterize as a wild-eyed environmental extremist advocacy organization, it's just about people planting trees, found it necessary to revise their hardiness zone map, which basically indicates which species and makes sense to try and grow where you live and which will be sort of pushing the envelope climatically speaking. So in 2006, they revised their plant hardiness zone map. Next slide, please. There's also a disease element to this. So last year was the first year that chikungunya virus made it from India to Italy. With any luck, the Italian winter will have wiped out the reservoir, and it won't happen again next summer. Next slide, please. But there are a whole series of connections between climate change and human health, sort of diagrammed here, some caused by weather, some caused by waterborne diseases, some going through vector-borne diseases. The point I want to make here is beyond human health, the same kinds of things are going to be happening to plant and animal species. Next slide, please. And this unreadable slide is deliberately unreadable. This is to make the point that this is no longer a matter of individual examples and anecdotes, that all this is robust statistically. Next slide, please. It is happening not just on land, it's happening in the marine systems of the world. Planktonic species are changing their distribution. Fish species are changing their distribution. Next, please. And in America's great estuary, the Chesapeake Bay, there are changes as well. Eelgrass, an important habitat for many species, including blue crab, turns out to have a very strict upper temperature limit. Next, please. And the southern boundary of the eelgrass in the Chesapeake Bay has been marching steadily northward. Not a good thing from the point of view of the blue crab fishermen. Next, please. Even in the tropics, we're already seeing changes. In the legendary cloud forest of Monteverde in Costa Rica, what's happening there is not so much temperature-driven, but the effects of climate and precipitation increasing the number of dry days every year by affecting the altitude at which, next please, clouds form. So there are more dry days in Monteverde, not a good thing for a cloud forest, which gets about 98% of its moisture from condensation from clouds. Next, please. It is thought that the first species, it is believed, I think is the better way to put this, the first species driven to extinction by climate change is this wonderful golden toad from Monteverde. Whether one accepts that science or not, and it's reasonably strong, but whether you accept it or not, next slide please, you can see other changes. And the legendary Quetzal, the iconic bird of the Aztecs, the bird of the national currency of Guatemala, is now suffering nest predation because toucans have moved upslope from the dry forests down below. Next, please. And in the oceans, the tropical forest equivalent, the wonderful technicolor world of coral reefs is also showing effects. When I was a graduate student, this is the way almost every coral reef in the world looked, teeming with life, colorful, except for the few places where they were suffering major sedimentation from land use problems. What it turns out is that the corals are extremely temperature sensitive, and only a couple degrees increase makes a very big difference in how they operate. And the coral is basically a partnership between a coral animal and an alga. And when that temperature limit is reached, the coral animal literally expels the alga. Next slide, please. And you get what are called bleaching events. These now occur in many places around the world with fair frequency. Basically, the technicolor world of the coral reefs goes to black and white. Next slide, please. Obviously, there are effects on animals that depend on ice. Next, please. Polar bear, of course, is the icon for all of that. But I just want to make the point there are dozens and dozens of species whose natural history depends on ice. And for example, many of the seabirds that nest in that part of the world nest on land and fly to the edge of the ice because their main food, the Arctic cod, only lives underneath the ice. So they basically, they forage along the edge of the Arctic ice. And as that distance to reach the ice increases, ultimately you get a point at which they cannot be successful nesters. Next, please. So that's all documented change. Things that are happening in the world of nature, in many senses, just minor ripples, no big events. But the real issue is, what does it look like for the natural world with the climate change that is built in from current greenhouse gas levels and beyond? Next, please. The first attempt to make an estimate of this was this paper in Nature in January 2004. I predicted that doubling pre-industrial levels would lead to commitment to extinction for 20 to 30% of all species on the planet. I'm not here to defend the particular calculations, but it is quite telling that the relatively conservative process of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, when it issued its report on the same topic last spring, came out with essentially the same range of 20 to 30%. Next, please. Just to remind us, climate change is not just about temperature, which is why I talk about it as climate change, not as global warming. Next, please. It's also about changes in precipitation. And I would remind you that if for terrestrial organisms, the two most important factors in the environment are temperature and moisture. For aquatic organisms, it's temperature and acidity, or pH. Next slide, please. We're already seeing a drying trend in the prairie pothole regions of the American Midwest. Hugely important dynamic ecosystem supporting the amazing Midwestern flyway. Next, please. And we have done some modeling. I didn't do this, but modeling has been done for particular species of value like the sugar maple. This is the current distribution of sugar maple in the United States. Next, please. This shows that all five major global computer models at double pre-industrial levels show that if you want to enjoy the autumn color provided by sugar maple, if you want sugar maple syrup or maple sugar, you're going to have to talk to the Canadians. Next slide, please. Clearly, freshwater systems will be affected as well. Cold water species like trout. This is why the current bill in Congress for climate change is called the Warner-Lieberman bill, because John Warner is a fly fisherman, and this particular issue made climate change real for him in a way that it hadn't been before. Next, please. And there will be complicated interactions as well. The Hawaiian Islands have this extraordinary evolutionary radiation of the Hawaiian honey creepers. Many of them are extinct, and the remaining ones, with I think one exception, are all very vulnerable, next slide please, to a bird malaria introduced to Hawaii and transmitted by an introduced mosquito. That mosquito currently does not live above a certain altitude where it's too cold for it. The mosquito line clearly is going to move up those mountain slopes, and these are conical structures after all, so they will get quite rapidly squeezed out of places to live. Next, please. We can already see something like this has happened with the American ash. We're an introduced species, an invasive species, the emerald ash borer, basically now has a longer summer, gets in an extra generation, and so there's a major dieback in American ash, which actually relates to that American icon called the baseball bat. Next, please. Species which live in high places, like the wonderful rabbit relative, lagomorph relative, the pika, has wonderful harvest behavior at the end of summer. There are about 8 or 10 places in the mountains of the West where pikas occur. And as the temperature changes and they move up in response to that, there will come a point where there's nowhere further to go, and those pika populations will wink out one by one. So that's representative of a plant and animal species which live in high places, which will be particularly vulnerable, as will, next slide please, those living on coastal areas will be vulnerable to sea level rise, and in particular those on low-lying islands, next slide please, like the key deer, will eventually reach a point where there is nowhere to go. So island species and mountaintop species are particularly vulnerable as we move into the future. Next, please. And the coral reefs are going to incur more and more frequent coral bleaching. It just is not a very encouraging picture for the future of tropical coral reefs. Next, please. You can model, you know, what will happen to a particular species like we did for the sugar maple. Some will be like this one in the Cape Floral Kingdom in South Africa, which will, this is one of the luckier ones. It will disappear from a big chunk of its current range, but be able to persist in some of it and even be able to acquire a little range expansion. Next, please. The Australians have modeled what will happen to the vertebrate species, the birds and mammal species that are unique to the Australian rainforests. The ring-tailed possum is one of those. Next slide, please. And if you just take us through that, you will see, next please, that with increasing climate change, and just keep tapping till it's over, thanks, you'll see that you eventually get to a point where none of them would be able to survive. So, next please. So, in addition to all of this, there are some serious complications. And complication number one, next please, is that we basically live in landscapes with natural habitat, which is fragmented. Glaciers came and went in the past. In this part of the world, not a lot of species were lost in the process. Species basically tracked their required conditions. But today, with the way we have modified landscapes, we've basically turned them into obstacle courses. As Michael Robinson, the former director of the National Zoo, liked to say, you know, that tree species would move, but Philadelphia is going to be in the way. So this is one of the major problems that has to be addressed. It's also one that pretty obvious to figure out what you do about it, is basically restore natural connections in the landscapes to make it easier for plant and animal species to move. Next, please. Second complication, which is harder to do anything about, is ecosystems, as we know from paleontology and paleoecology, ecosystems just don't pick up and move as a unit. It's the individual species that move, each in its own direction and at its own rate. Next slide, please. So this shows three mammal species, two tree species, and one insect species, and how they moved after the retreat of the last glacier in Europe. Clearly, there is no consistent pattern there, and what we can look forward to is ecosystems that will disassemble as the individual species move at their own rates and in their own directions, and then the survivals will assemble into ecosystems which are really hard to envision. Next, please. I'm going to take you along an altitudinal gradient. This is sort of hypothetical in the Andes, but it will give you some sense of the dynamics that we're likely to see almost anywhere. This one will be along an altitudinal gradient, next slide please, which is sort of truncated at the top by grazing activity, where there's an artificially low tree line, and it's essentially a form of fragmentation and obstacle course issue. Next slide, please. Next. This goes into a lot of detail, but some species, the species will respond individually, as I've been describing. Some will migrate upslope, some may not need to. Next. And some may need to, but are unable to and go extinct. And I think there's one more. And then there's going to be a big problem at the top. Some things will run up against an artificial barrier. Well, that again is something one can plan ahead to change and make it easier for species to move. Next, please. In addition, we know that change will not be linear and gradual. Next, please. The climate system doesn't work this way. We already talked about it. This is the global conveyor belt, which moves heat around the oceans. It has been known to shut down in the geologic past. But next slide, please. It is the abrupt changes and the threshold changes that in ecosystems, which I want to draw your attention to. And the most dramatic one we've seen so far involves the coniferous forests of southern Alaska, British Columbia, the Northwest, and Colorado, in which the longer summer allows the native pine bark beetle to get in one more generation, and in many places lead to 70% of the trees being killed by the beetles. Next slide, please. This is going to take us through, in British Columbia, outbreaks and then compensating factors beating the beetles back for about a 40-year period. And during the first part of it, you probably can't even see these tiny little red dots. But it's all very local. You know, small places it happens. But as time goes on, the summers are getting longer, and the beetles are getting in an extra generation. And sometimes they get beaten back. But it's basically a geometric curve of population increase, and when you add one more generation, the beetles get the upper hand. Next, please. So this is a serious fire management problem, it's a serious timber management problem, but more important, as one thinks about this whole issue, it's a threshold change in ecosystems. Something like this has been seen in the pinyon pine in the Southwest as well. Next, please. And we're also, if we could click on that, very vulnerable to larger changes, system changes. And this marvelous image shows how moisture is generated around the world. It's based on real data, and most of it is generated over the oceans and at the equator. And one of the big exceptions to this is the Amazon. So what you can see there is that the moisture comes off the Atlantic and gets to South America and the Amazon, and it continues to generate moisture. The Amazon is thought to make about half of its own rainfall. That system shut down in the summer of 2005 with a circulation pattern change in the Atlantic. And they had the greatest drought in the history of the Amazon, in the recorded history. It is thought that that is a preview of what climate change could bring. So if you have that shutting down, next slide, please. You can have something happen which the climate change specialists call Amazon dieback. And basically, next slide, please. This just shows the loss of biomass from Amazon dieback and all of the major computer models. You have major dieback of the Amazon and at least the eastern portion of the Amazon. Just a major change. Next slide, please. The other huge system change slipped by us almost unnoticed until about 5 years ago, and that is increased acidity of the world's oceans. Because in addition to affecting the oceans by temperature, the oceans, which absorb a lot of CO2 and actually are responsible for the climate change problem being less than it otherwise would be, at the same time are converting some of that CO2 into carbonic acid. So the oceans today are a tenth of a pH unit more acid than in pre-industrial times. It's a logarithmic scale, so it doesn't sound like much, but in relative terms, it's 30% more acid. Next slide, please. Well, why should we worry about it other than the fact that it seems really amazing to change the chemistry of two-thirds of the planet like that? It turns out there are tens of thousands of species in the oceans which build skeletons and shells out of calcium carbonate. Next slide. That comes from utilizing a carbonate equilibrium in the oceans, which is both temperature and pH dependent. So as it becomes more acid, it is harder for most organisms to build their shells and skeletons. Next slide, please. Click on it. And some of these are these tiny little microorganisms, like this pteropod. It's actually a tiny, tiny little mollusks which use their foot and have it adapted to sort of fly through the water. And these are important organisms at the base of major food chains in the oceans. There's a paper in Today's Science which suggests that phytoplankton, as opposed to zooplankton like this, might be able to compensate. That's an experimental result. I am told by people who I respect that we'll soon be seeing a couple papers about changes detected at the base of the food chains off of Alaska and in the North Atlantic. Next slide, please. So other kinds of system change will come from the thawing of the tundra region, the release of previously frozen methane and CO2. Next slide, please. And we know, sort of in a fuzzy kind of way, that the Earth system as a whole has certain parts of it which have critical thresholds. We don't really understand it very well, but they certainly are likely to become tipped more easily if climate change continues unabated. Next slide, please. So that's a pretty bleak picture I painted. I think it's a very real picture. So what can you do about it? And what I like to say is my profession has changed from being an ecologist and a conservationist to the broader one of being a planet doctor. Has to worry about all these factors interacting with each other. Well, there are things that one can do. This is all not hopeless. You can adapt conservation strategies to this changing climate situation, and you can also work on limiting further climate change. Next, please. So this is just a diagram of what the current bill under consideration in Congress would do to lowering greenhouse gases. Anyway, there's going to have to be a radical revision of the energy base of society, and there is no single silver bullet to this. It's a sort of a silver buckshot kind of thing, and you're going to need to do about 7 or 8 different things, different kinds of renewable energy, biofuels, energy conservation can do a lot, etc. Next slide, please. But for the natural world, we're going to have to spend a lot of time revising what we do to assist what is now technically under the Climate Convention called adaptation. And for those who can't read this little cartoon, it says, yes sirree, this adapting to a new environment stuff is rough. I have a feeling it's going to take a really, really long time. And that's true. Next slide, please. So, next. One of the things one can do is work actively to put natural connections back into the environment to make it easier for species to move in response to climate change. Next slide, please. Minimizing the other ways in which we are affecting life on Earth actually minimizes the possibility of negative synergies between climate change and those factors. And we now have the wonderful ability, literally on laptop computers, to generate downscaled climate projections of a 30 to 40 or 50 year range in the future. And that's really important because the big global models are such a coarse scale, they're useless for a manager. These kinds of things will come down to like a 10 kilometer by 10 kilometer grid. And that's exactly the kind of level that managers of natural resources will need to make decisions. And you can do it on a laptop, you know, for like 10,000 bucks for a major region. Next, please. You can go back and look what will happen to particular species you care about and adapt your management strategy accordingly. Next slide, please. Next. And in specific cases where a species is highly valued, you can even assist the migration of that species to its future location. But clearly, you can only do that for a limited number. Next slide, please. I am sure that as the public begins to understand the challenge of climate change for nature, that you will encounter a reaction basically saying that, you know, all those protected areas you talked us into paying for basically were a waste of money. You know, all the species you're trying to protect when we did that are going to be living somewhere else. That was all a waste of money. Well, in fact, that is absolutely the wrong way to look at that. The existing protected areas are the current safe havens from which those species will be able to move and create the future biogeographic patterns of life. So basically, we need more conservation, not less. Next, please. And then two final points. In that annual increase of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, 20% of it, roughly, comes from the destruction of tropical forests. Brazil, which is pretty good on the energy side, is actually the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases because of what goes on in Amazon deforestation. Indonesia, similarly, is number four. So anything we can do to reduce tropical deforestation actually is not only good for the forests and the biodiversity, it's also good from a climate change point of view. And we're now entering a phase where that kind of mechanism is going to be discussed and I believe included in the trading system in the next couple of years as the Climate Change Convention works to its next format. So that's good for the forests and good for climate change. That's what the forests in the Amazon look like in the place I took Warren to, but we were inside a forest looking out at that. Next slide, please. And then finally, yes.
Deforestation, what is the purpose of that? Is that for lumber, for agriculture?
Tropical deforestation varies in what causes it, depending where you are in the world. So some of the major drivers in Brazil are expansion of soy bean agriculture, expansion of cattle, and then there's a chunk which is just spontaneous colonization by landless people. So finally, I really want to hammer home how important it is to get busy on this immediately. This graph comes from the final synthesis report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And I think maybe we just leave it on the screen because it'll be hard to see the small print in the back. And you don't need to see it to understand the points because I'm going to draw them out for you, but you might want to look at it in detail. So on the left is temperature change. Right there is basically zero, basically the pre-industrial situation. And the red line is the actual measured temperature increase, essentially the 3/4 of a degree I referred to. And the other lines are projections from business as usual to optimistic, and time is across the bottom. The point I want to make is if you actually think about what we're already stuck with, it means we're going to end up at 1.5. At that point, IPCC believes most coral reefs will be bleached and dead systems, and that 10 to 15% of species will be committed to extinction. At 2.0, right here, it's where a lot of biologists and conservation organizations are saying things get very disruptive for nature. I think if at 3/4 of a degree we're already seeing threshold changes in ecosystems, that's probably being awfully generous. And at 2.5, which is only 1 degree more than what we're stuck with, is where you get Amazon dieback. So I think in many ways this graph summarizes how big and urgent the climate change issue is. And I'll be happy to answer any questions, either formally right now or mingling afterwards. Thank you very much.